Chapter 5. Hacking. All teenagers are hackers. They have to be, if only because their life circumstances are untenable. They think they're adults, but the adults think they're kids. Remember, if you can, your own teen years. You were a hacker, too, willing to do anything to evade parental supervision. Basically, you were fed up with being treated like a child. Recall how it felt when anyone older and bigger than you sought to control you, as if age and size were identical with authority. At one time or another, your parents, teachers, coaches, scoutmasters, and clergy would all take advantage of their position to invade your private life, impose their expectations on your future, and enforce your conformity to past standards. Whenever these adults substituted their hopes, dreams, and desires for your own, they were doing so, by their account, for your own good, or with your best interests at heart. And while sometimes this was true, we all remember those other times when it wasn't. When "because I said so" wasn't enough, and "you'll thank me one day" rang hollow. If you've ever been an adolescent, you've surely been on the receiving end of one of those cliches, and so on the losing end of an imbalance of power. To grow up is to realize the extent to which your existence has been governed by systems of rules, vague guidelines, and increasingly unsupportable norms that have been imposed on you without your consent and are subject to change at a moment's notice. There were even some rules that you'd only find out about after you'd violated them. If you were anything like me, you were scandalized. If you were anything like me, you were nearsighted, scrawny, and age-wise barely entering the double digits when you first started to wonder about politics. In school, you were told that in the system of American politics, citizens give consent through the franchise to be governed by their equals. This is democracy. But democracy certainly wasn't in place in my U.S. history class, where, if my classmates and I had the vote, Mr. Martin would have been out of a job. Instead, Mr. Martin made the rules for U.S. history. Ms. Evans made the rules for English. Mr. Sweeney made the rules for science. Mr. Stockton made the rules for math. And all of those teachers constantly changed those rules to benefit themselves and maximize their power. If a teacher didn't want you to go to the bathroom, you'd better hold it in. If a teacher promised a field trip to the Smithsonian Institution but then canceled it for an imaginary infraction, they'd offer no explanation beyond citing their broad authority and the maintenance of proper order. Even back then, I realized that any opposition to this system would be difficult, not least because getting its rules changed to serve the interests of the majority would involve persuading the rulemakers to put themselves at a purposeful disadvantage. That, ultimately, is the critical flaw or design defect intentionally integrated into every system in both politics and computing. The people who create the rules have no incentive to act against themselves. What convinced me that school, at least, was an illegitimate system was that it wouldn't recognize any legitimate dissent. I could plead my case until I lost my voice, or I could just accept the fact that I'd never had a voice to begin with. However, the benevolent tyranny of school, like all tyrannies, has a limited shelf life. At a certain point, the denial of agency becomes a license to resist, though it's characteristic of adolescents to confuse resistance with escapism or even violence. The most common outlets for a rebellious teen were useless to me, because I was too cool for vandalism and not cool enough for drugs. To this day, I've never even gotten drunk on liquor or smoked a cigarette. Instead, I started hacking, which remains the sanest, healthiest, and most educational way I know for kids to assert autonomy and address adults on equal terms. Like most of my classmates, I didn't like the rules, but was afraid of breaking them. I knew how the system worked. You corrected a teacher's mistake, you got a warning. You confronted the teacher when they didn't admit the mistake, you got detention. Someone cheated off your exam, and though you didn't expressly let them cheat, you got detention, and the cheater got suspended. This is the origin of all hacking. The awareness of a systemic linkage between input and output, between cause and effect. Because hacking isn't just native to computing. It exists wherever rules do. To hack a system requires getting to know its rules better than the people who created it or are running it, and exploiting all the vulnerable distance between how those people had intended the system to work and how it actually works, or could be made to work. In capitalizing on these unintentional uses, hackers aren't breaking the rules as much as debunking them. Humans are hardwired to recognize patterns. All the choices we make are informed by a cache of assumptions, both empirical and logical, unconsciously derived and consciously developed. We use these assumptions to assess the potential consequences of each choice, and we describe the ability to do all of this quickly and accurately as intelligence. But even the smartest among us rely on assumptions that we've never put to the test. And because we do, the choices we make are often flawed. Anyone who knows better, or thinks more quickly and more accurately than we do, can take advantage of those flaws to create consequences that we never expected. It's this egalitarian nature of hacking, which doesn't care who you are, just how you reason, that makes it such a reliable method of dealing with the type of authority figures so convinced of their system's righteousness that it never occurred to them to test it. I didn't learn any of this at school, of course. I learned it online. The internet gave me the chance to pursue all the topics I was interested in, and all the links between them, unconstrained by the pace of my classmates and my teachers. The more time I spent online, however, the more my schoolwork felt extracurricular. The summer I turned 13, I resolved never to return, or at least to seriously reduce my classroom commitments. I wasn't quite sure how I'd swing that, though. All the plans I came up with were likely to backfire. If I was caught skipping class, my parents would revoke my computer privileges. If I decided to drop out, they'd bury my body deep in the woods and tell the neighbors I'd run away. I had to come up with a hack. And then, on the first day of the new school year, I found one. Indeed, it was basically handed to me. At the start of each class, the teachers passed out their syllabi, detailing the material to be covered, the required reading, and the schedule of tests and quizzes and assignments. Along with these, they gave us their grading policies, which were essentially explanations of how A's, B's, C's, and D's were calculated. I'd never encountered information like this. Their numbers and letters were like a strange equation that suggested a solution to my problem. After school that day, I sat down with the syllabi and did the math to figure out which aspects of each class I could simply ignore and still expect to receive a passing grade. Take my U.S. history class, for example. According to the syllabus, quizzes were worth 25%, tests were worth 35%, term papers were worth 15%, homework was worth 15%, and class participation, that most subjective of categories in every subject, was worth 10%. Because I usually did well on my quizzes and tests without having to do too much studying, I could count on them for a reliable pool of time-efficient points. Term papers and homework, however, were the major time sucks, low-value, high-cost impositions on me time. What all those numbers told me was that if I didn't do any homework but aced everything else, I'd wind up with a cumulative grade of 85, a B. If I didn't do any homework or write any term papers but aced everything else, I'd wind up with a cumulative grade of 70, a C-. The 10% that was class participation would be my buffer. Even if the teacher gave me a zero in that, if they interpreted my participation as disruption, I could still manage a 65, a D-. I'd still pass. My teacher's systems were terminally flawed. Their instructions for how to achieve the highest grade could be used as instructions for how to achieve the highest freedom, a key to how to avoid doing what I didn't like to do and still slide by. The moment I figured that out, I stopped doing homework completely. Every day was bliss, the kind of bliss forbidden to anybody old enough to work and pay taxes, until Mr. Stockton asked me in front of the entire class why I hadn't handed in the past half dozen or so homework assignments. Untouched as I was by the guile of age and forgetting for a moment that by giving away my hack, I was depriving myself of an advantage, I cheerfully offered my equation to the math teacher. My classmates' laughter lasted just a moment before they set about scribbling, calculating whether they too could afford to adopt a post-homework life. "Pretty clever, Eddie," Mr. Stockton said, moving on to the next lesson with a smile. I was the smartest kid in school, until about 24 hours later, when Mr. Stockton passed out the new syllabus. This stated that any student who failed to turn in more than 6 homeworks by the end of the semester would get an automatic F. "Pretty clever, Mr. Stockton." Then he took me aside after class and said, "You should be using that brain of yours not to figure out how to avoid work, but how to do the best work you can. You have so much potential, Ed. But I don't think you realize that the grades you get here will follow you for the rest of your life. You have to start thinking about your permanent record." Unshackled from homework, at least for a while, and so with more time to spare, I also did some more conventional, computer-based hacking. As I did, my abilities improved. At the bookstore, I'd page through tiny, blurrily photocopied, stapled-together hacker zines with names like 2600 and Frack, absorbing their techniques and, in the process, absorbing their anti-authoritarian politics. I was at the bottom of the technical totem pole, a script-kidding noob working with tools I didn't understand that functioned according to principles that were beyond me. People still ask me why, when I finally did gain some proficiency, I didn't race out to empty bank accounts or steal credit card numbers. The honest answer is that I was too young and dumb to even know that this was an option, let alone to know what I'd do with the stolen loot. All I wanted, all I needed, I already had for free. Instead, I figured out simple ways to hack some games, giving myself extra lives and letting me do things like see through walls. Also, there wasn't a lot of money on the internet back then, at least not by today's standards. The closest that anyone I knew or anything I read ever came to theft was phreaking or making free phone calls. If you asked some of the big-shot hackers of the day why, for example, they'd hacked into a major news site only to do nothing more meaningful than replace the headlines with a trippy gif proclaiming the skills of Baron von Hackerface that would be taken down in less than half an hour, the reply would have been a version of the answer given by the mountaineer who was asked his reason for climbing Mount Everest. Because it's there. Most hackers, particularly young ones, set out to search not for lucre or power, but for the limits of their talent and any opportunity to prove the impossible possible. I was young, and while my curiosity was pure, it was also, in retrospect, pretty psychologically revealing, in that some of my earliest hacking attempts were directed toward allaying my neuroses. The more I came to know about the fragility of computer security, the more I worried over the consequences of trusting the wrong machine. As a teenager, my first hack that ever courted trouble dealt with a fear that suddenly became all I could think about, the threat of a full-on, scorched-earth nuclear holocaust. I'd been reading some article about the history of the American nuclear program, and before I knew it, with just a couple of clicks, I was at the website of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, the country's nuclear research facility. That's just the way the internet works. You get curious, and your fingers do the thinking for you. But suddenly, I was legitimately freaked out. The website of America's largest and most significant scientific research and weapons development institution, I noticed, had a glaring security hole. Its vulnerability was basically the virtual version of an unlocked door, an open directory structure. I'll explain. Imagine I sent you a link to download a PDF file that's kept on its own page of a multi-page website. The URL for this file would typically be something like website.com/files/pdfs/filename.pdf. Now, as the structure of a URL derives directly from directory structure, each part of this URL represents a distinct branch of the directory tree. In this instance, within the directory of website.com is a folder of files, within which is a subfolder of PDFs, within which is the specific filename.pdf that you're seeking to download. Today, most websites will confine your visit to that specific file, keeping their directory structures closed and private. But back in those dinosaur days, even major websites were created and run by folks who were new to the technology, and they often left their directory structures wide open, which meant that if you truncated your file's URL, if you simply changed it to something like website.com/files, you'd be able to access every file on the site, PDF or otherwise, including those that weren't necessarily meant for visitors. This was the case with the Los Alamos site. In the hacking community, this is basically baby's first hack, a totally rudimentary traversal procedure known as dir walking, or directory walking. And that's just what I did. I walked as fast as I could from file to subfolder to upper-level folder and back again, a teen let loose through the parent directories. Within a half hour of reading an article about the threat of nuclear weapons, I'd stumbled upon a trove of files meant only for the lab's security-cleared workers. To be sure, the documents I accessed weren't exactly the classified plans for building a nuclear device in my garage, and anyway, it's not as if those plans weren't already available on about a dozen DIY websites. Instead, what I got was more along the lines of confidential inter-office memoranda and other personal employee information. Still, as someone suddenly acutely worried about mushroom clouds on the horizon, and also especially as the child of military parents, I did what I figured I was supposed to do. I told an adult. I sent an explanatory email to the laboratory's webmaster about the vulnerability and waited for a response that never came. Every day after school, I visited the site to check if the directory structure had changed, and it hadn't. Nothing had changed, except my capacity for shock and indignation. I finally got on the phone, my house's second line, and called the general information phone number listed at the bottom of the laboratory's site. An operator picked up. And the moment she did, I started stammering. I don't even think I got to the end of the phrase directory structure before my voice broke. The operator interrupted with a curt, "Please hold for IT." And before I could thank her, she transferred me to a voicemail. By the time of the beep, I'd regained some modicum of confidence, and with a steadier larynx, I left a message. All I recall now of that message was how I ended it. With relief, and by repeating my name and phone number. I think I even spelled out my name, like my father sometimes did, using the military phonetic alphabet. Sierra November Oscar Whiskey Delta Echo November. Then I hung up and went on with my life, which for a week consisted pretty much exclusively of checking the Los Alamos website. Nowadays, given the government's cyber intelligence capabilities, anyone who was pinging the Los Alamos servers a few dozen times a day would almost certainly become a person of interest. Back then, however, I was merely an interested person. I couldn't understand. Didn't anybody care? Weeks passed, and weeks can feel like months to a teenager. Until one evening, just before dinner, the phone rang. My mother, who was in the kitchen making dinner, picked up. I was at the computer in the dining room when I heard it was for me. "Yes, he's here." Then, "May I ask who's calling?" I turned around in my seat. And she was standing over me, holding the phone against her chest. All the color had left her face. She was trembling. Her whisper had a mournful urgency I'd never heard before, and it terrified me. "What did you do?" Had I known, I would have told her. Instead, I asked, "Who is it?" "Los Alamos, the nuclear laboratory." "Oh, thank God." I gently pried the phone away from her and sat her down. "Hello?" On the line was a friendly representative from Los Alamos IT, who kept calling me Mr. Snowden. He thanked me for reporting the problem and informed me that they'd just fixed it. I restrained myself from asking what had taken so long. I restrained myself from reaching over to the computer and immediately checking the site. My mother hadn't taken her eyes off me. She was trying to piece together the conversation, but could only hear one side. I gave her a thumbs up. And then, to further reassure her, I offered an older, serious, and unconvincingly deep voice and stiffly explained to the IT rep what he already knew, how I'd found the directory traversal problem, how I'd reported it, and how I hadn't received any response until now. I finished up with, "I really appreciate your telling me. I hope I didn't cause any problems." "Not at all," the IT rep said, and then asked what I did for a living. "Nothing really," I said. He asked whether I was looking for a job, and I said, "During the school year, I'm pretty busy, but I've got a lot of vacation, and the summers are free." That's when the light bulb went off, and he realized he was dealing with a teenager. "Well, kid," he said, "you've got my contact. Be sure to get in touch when you turn 18. Now, pass me along to that nice lady I spoke to." I handed the phone to my anxious mother, and she took it back with her into the kitchen, which was filling up with smoke. Dinner was burnt, but I'm guessing the IT rep said enough complimentary things about me that any punishment I was imagining went out the window.